National Association of Evangelicals, that's an organization that lobbies the U.S. government on policy issues that are near and dear to evangelicals' hearts, invited us to speak at a conference they were holding for their board. And the conference dealt with a range of issues, but we and a number of Palestinian Christian leaders were asked to speak about the status of Christians in the Holy Land, our ministries, and how they are affected by the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So that is a terrible subject for a sermon. And there are 100 different reasons why it would be a bad idea to deliver a sermon on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But I can suggest a couple. Only if you're new here, you might be thinking, Israeli-Palestinian conflict from the pulpit. This should be interesting. Everyone else here at best is thinking, oh great, here he goes, he's going to offend lots of people. That's at best. And everyone else would be thinking, this is going to be heretical and blasphemous and I wish he'd just shut up. Okay. An altar call. Right, because in either case, the chances of anyone drawing any life lesson or personal application that is spiritually edifying, Christine mentioned spiritual edification, would be close to nil. Because most people would just be looking, you know, how is this going to confirm what I already believe or contradict what I already believe or... So without going to any specifics of any of the policy recommendations that we supported, I thought I would mention just a couple aspects that I think that we can identify with. Firstly, I simply felt a bit of a fraud in even entertaining the suggestion that American evangelical leaders should make this issue, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or either of the people groups on their own, for that matter, a top priority among foreign policy concerns. After all, it is impossible to ignore that as bad as it has been recently, this conflict is not in any way the worst conflict in the region or in the world, as some have ludicrously suggested. The Syrian civil war of the last 4 years alone has already claimed several hundred thousand more lives than the entire Arab-Jewish conflict of the past 150 years. So I said something along the lines of the following. I do not believe, therefore, that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the cause of all the terrible crises that are tearing the Middle East apart, and I certainly do not believe that solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the magical key or silver bullet to restoring the region to sanity. There's not much difference between that canard and more sinister anti-Semitic libels that blamed Jews for all kinds of ills around the world. That said, precisely because the conflict is so intractable, precisely because it garners so much attention, if we as believers can succeed where everyone else has failed, imagine the redemptive power of that message. Right now, we look a lot like everybody else. We Christians are divided along the same lines, hold the same grudges and prejudices, and often contribute to the problem as if our faith made no difference at all. But imagine if it really were true that among believers our identity in Christ actually came first. Imagine the impact that the church could have if it truly represented a united, reconciled body. Try to picture how we look to the majority populations of Jews and Muslims in the land. Christians comprise barely 2% within the state of Israel and less than 1% in the Palestinian territories. And yet this tiny minority is splintered, shattered into literally scores of denominations and sects, from traditional Catholics and Orthodox to our multifarious Protestant rabble. So even when we try to stand out and be a witness by providing the best health care and education, and we do, and live as exceptionally upright and good-standing citizens, you can imagine how so often any positive witness is drowned out by the cacophony and incoherence of scores of discordant denominational voices all claiming hold of the one truth. If we can't reconcile, then we have nothing to say to the world. If we proclaim Jesus, but his body remains in tatters, our gospel message is hollow and bankrupt. If we are going to make an impact, then what we are offering can be nothing short of revolutionary. So that's what I said. And I know I'm biased because this is my home, but I didn't want to just create some false sense of urgency about the place I love. I think it's true to the pattern repeated in the so often with biblical Israel, which was always insignificant from a geopolitical standpoint, but made great among the nations for God's namesake. This, of course, is where it gets dangerous, because people will want to quote the curses as well, ascribing blesses and curses to specific modern-day political entities according to their very different interpretations of politics. I'm being vague, I know. Now, I'm not saying that these views are all wrong or unimportant, but clearly they often take too prominent a role and hinder our relations with people. And that should be an indication that something has gone awry. This can happen with any theology or ideology. Take the way we who live here come to develop negative attitudes towards Christians who don't live here, and in general aren't sufficiently informed about this place. There is a virtual caste system of the initiated and the uninitiated, those who are integrated and those who remain on the fringes because they don't reach a certain level of knowledge and acculturation. I can see how this dynamic has often poisoned my life. For example, growing up, I went to a public Israeli high school during grammar school, and then for high school, I attended the Anglican school, a private Christian school in English. The Anglican school is certainly one of the best schools in the city, but I felt I didn't have enough access to Israeli or Palestinian society while I was there. On the other hand, those of us who knew Hebrew or Arabic there at the Anglican school, even if we were losing our fluency the longer we stayed there, certainly felt superior to the expats who came from abroad and had no connections or reference to the country. In the meantime, I nurtured an inferiority complex towards my friends who completed public school in Hebrew or Arabic, that they were better integrated in Israeli or Palestinian society. So gradually I came to scoff at the very idea of private schools as elitist and isolationist. And I always vowed I would send my children to a local public school. I thought I'd found a perfect solution in the school my boys attend now, which is a bilingual, binational Hebrew-Arabic school where half the students are Palestinian and half are Jews. Yet, ironically, now I see that I've sent my boys into an environment that is absolutely a bubble, entirely unique to its environment, and possibly even snooty. I've seen now how individual schools, whether Christian or public, can be failing systems and foster environments that are unhealthy. And in any case, today, certainly in Jerusalem, there is no simple public-private dichotomy, and there is much more of a recognition of a need for of a variety of schools and that meet different giftings and interests. For the first time in my life, I suddenly began to see many of my own hypocrisies and prejudices regarding schools and communities who choose to establish institutions with particular identities. And certainly after visiting Keith Blystra, who many of you know was from this church many years, this week there in Michigan, we got to visit him at the new Christian school that he teaches at there in Holland, Michigan. A fantastic school, amazing. And it was very difficult to find a downside. But that is just an example of how we, or I anyway, can have such strong views of how we are meant to live our lives that we come not to value each other or value each other less. I know that as we look around the room, there are people whose work or ministry we consider to be of greater or lesser value. And because of that, we value them as people to a greater or lesser degree. So it's interesting, we speak to people abroad, or we expect people to come here and to hear us or receive our writings and to see things our way, to be convinced of our truth, because Christians in the West or abroad should care about what is happening here, about the believing community here. But the truth is, we don't even care about the believing community here, outside our narrow interests that we have carefully, very carefully and specifically defined. We don't have time for the rest. A few weeks ago, I went to a demonstration held by Palestinian Israeli Christians in front of the Prime Minister's office to protest the lack of funding for Christian schools in the country. Some of the evangelical organizers had complained that their brothers and sisters here and around the world have not been supporting them as they had hoped. And sure enough, I didn't see many others there that day. And I don't think I am congratulating myself, because I wouldn't have gone if it hadn't been for the fact that I had just spoken to one of them days earlier about this very issue, so I practically didn't have a choice. There had been plenty of burning issues and high-profile events that I was planning on going to, but never did, for no good reason. One of them was another struggling school seeking official recognition, the Messianic Jewish Makor HaTikva, that had invited members of the community to support them on the day when they were in court, and I never made it. Interestingly, at that Palestinian Christian schools demonstration that day, Knesset member Ayman Ode was one of the speakers rallying at the crowd. Ode is a senior, he's the senior representative of the United List of Arab Knesset members in the Israeli Knesset. He's also head of the Hadash party, a mostly Arab and secular-leaning party that has among its members a smaller Jewish contingent as well. Arde comes from a Muslim family, but like many of the Palestinian-Israeli intelligentsia, he is a graduate of a Christian school. In his case, he was the only Muslim in his class, and he takes great pride in the fact that he got an A in his final exam in New Testament. He considers himself secular today, but I say all this as relevant background because at one point during his speech, in which he argued that they as Palestinians deserved equal treatment, he shouted, "We are not like the Canaanite woman in the Gospel of Matthew, who begged for crumbs from the master's table. This is our land. Justice is ours." So there are many things one could say about someone like Ode making a reference like that in Arabic in front of the office of the Prime Minister of the State of Israel. The fact that he even can indicates maybe a higher degree of biblical literacy than some might expect from either him or his audience. In a way, although it probably wasn't his intention, he was criticizing the sentiment as it seems to come across in the original biblical text. It is difficult not to understand it the way he did. This is the story in Matthew. Leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. A Canaanite woman from the vicinity came to him crying out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is suffering terribly from demon possession." Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came to him and urged him, "Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us." He answered, "I was only sent to the lost sheep of Israel." The woman came and knelt before him. "Lord, help me," she said. He replied, "Is it not right to take It is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs. Yes, Lord, she said, but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table. Then Jesus answered, Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted. And her daughter was healed from that very hour. This, on the face of it, is a brutally harsh story. It is the epitome of all the worst manifestations of what we've been talking about. And that, I believe, is the point. I think Jesus is drawing attention to all of the worst tendencies that had started to crop up in the multicultural society he lived in. I think that he's saying all these horrible things, that as he's saying all these horrible things, he's looking at his disciples with a twinge of irony and more than a heavy dose of incredulity that they could go along with such a narrow-minded sentiment. Yeah, I can't help this needy woman. I was only sent to a specific ethnic group, the lost sheep of Israel. As if to say in another context, yeah, let's make sure to carry a whites-only sign so that it's clear to everyone from now on. And so when the woman cried out, Lord, help me. I imagine Jesus there looking not at the woman, but straight at his disciples as he said slowly, maybe even pointing with his finger so they understood exactly who he was referring to with his metaphor. It is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs. Then he must have known that this brave Canaanite woman was both persistent and witty, because he needed her wit to be piercing. Yes, Lord, she said, but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. Then Jesus, yes, even the dogs. You hear that, disciples? Even the dogs. Listen to where the ramifications of your theology have led you. You have allowed your theology to justify discrimination to the point where you now treat dogs better than people. As for you, dear woman, thank you for persevering this awful humiliation. That is some faith you have. And of course it is sufficient. You've already got your miracle. But you have also gone down as history as an example of how to overcome these pathetic, intolerant, bigoted followers of mine. You did it with persistence, shrewd wit, grace, and great faith.